This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, welcome into this week's episode of the Show Before the Show podcast, the official podcast of Minor League Baseball, as we're nearly like in the holiday season. I should have had like some bells to jingle, well, it's probably too early. Would that have made you angry? Hey! Ben's got keys. My name is Tyler Vaughn. That's Benjamin Hill jingling the keys, and Sam Dykstra in New York City. Hey guys, are you on the "it's too early for Christmas music" bandwagon? What's the take?
I mean, yes, it is too early for Christmas music. I say that as we're currently staring at a Christmas tree. Mind you, it's Radio City Music Hall that we're staring at. Radio City Music Hall has to sell tickets to the Rockettes, which is a big Christmas spectacular. I get it. There's a reason why they put the tree up. Even now on a podcast, we are now talking about the Rockettes because they put up a tree.
True.
That's why they do it. If you want to talk about Christmas getting too commercial, that is a big point in that favor. But no, I think we're not even close to talking about Christmas music or any holiday music yet. There's not even Thanksgiving music. I would say,
why don't we have any Thanksgiving music? Yeah. The turkey song, I guess.
Yeah. But otherwise, no, I don't.
Yeah, even Halloween got the Monster Mash. Why is there no good Thanksgiving song?
Is there a good
Ben? I can't think of any Thanksgiving at all. I just feel grateful for the existence of music during Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for? Music.
I like that.
Music in general.
Yeah. That's good. It's my favorite holiday. I love Thanksgiving. A day where we all just get to gorge ourselves and watch sports. It's pretty much the rest of my life also. But, I love it on Thanksgiving when everybody else joins in it. As we welcome you into this week's episode of the Show Before the Show, as noted, I'm Tyler, Sam and Ben in New York City. We're diving into some off-season elements of the show as we get closer and closer to the holiday season, the shopping season. Get the favorite minor league baseball fan in your life some sweet gear. You can go to the MILB shop. You can also check out the team stores as well. We've got some upcoming logo changes, some new identities, all that type of stuff. And we'll talk about those, of course, as they come out here over the next few weeks. But as we get into this week's episode of the show, we've got more ballpark guide stuff to break down and digest. An off-season project that we have been tackling now for several weeks, myself, Josh Jackson, Benjamin Hill, of course. We've had some fun with these so far. And Ben, I know you've got a new one coming up next week. I had a story about Hartford come out this week. Josh had the Inland Empire 66ers ballpark guide come out this week. We were talking before we started recording about how much fun this project has been, but it's a very neat little opportunity for us to 30,000 foot view, look at the world of minor league baseball. And these have been really cool to do.
Yeah. The most recent, Tyler, is yours. As you mentioned, on the Hartford Yard Goats, I'm currently working on the Syracuse Mets NBT Bank ballpark that should be out next week, and got Las Vegas, the Aviators after that on the docket. But the two latest to come out are a good pal, Josh Jackson, wrote a great one on the Inland Empire 66ers, and you've got one on Dunkin' Donuts Park, home of the Hartford Yard Goats. I was able to visit there in their inaugural season of 2017, which is, if you remember, was a year after what the inaugural season was supposed to be. And it was, we could do a very special episode and talk for 3 hours about what a mess it was to get that ballpark built. So much negative publicity, but then it opened. They had a great front office in place, great branding with the Yard Goats. And it really is one of the best ballparks you'll find in minor league baseball, bar none.
Yeah, people really forgot about all of the negative publicity pretty quickly once the gates opened to Dunkin' Donuts Park. And huge thanks to Mike Abramson, who is one of our, of course, longtime friends in the mill world, who had talked with me for that story and just kind of gave me the lowdown of how the ballpark has. It's one thing to open a ballpark and have it be gorgeous and beautiful and all of that. It's another thing to start developing the identity of a ballpark over the last several years. And that's what they've been able to do at Dunkin' Donuts Park. And so we talked about, you know, best areas of the ballpark to sit. Mike's partial to the third base side because you get the Hartford city skyline in the background. There's an overhang in right field. They sort of wedge the ballpark into kind of a modified city block. So there's a short porch in right field, and they've got seats on the lower level, but they also have an upper level, which kind of gives it more of a big league ballpark feel. They've got, you know, local food vendors. Dame Drops, who is the very famous YouTube food reviewer. I did not know this, but he is from the Hartford area and collaborated with the Yard Goats on a concession stand this year. So they've got some Dame Drops created and approved food items. It was a lot of fun talking with Mike Abramson about Dunkin' Donuts Park. And if you ever find yourself in the Northeast, make sure to swing through Hartford and make a stop at Dunkin' Donuts Park and take in a Yard Goats game. It is a gorgeous place to watch baseball. A lot of cool food and drink options. And there's also a lot of neat historical options around the ballpark too. That's one of the things that we have been keen to dive into with the ballpark guides is, you know, you're going to be at a baseball game, sure, but there's also a lot of stuff that you should explore outside of these ballpark facilities themselves. And in Hartford, you've got the Mark Twain House, a place where Mark Twain, Samuel Longhorn Clemens, lived during his writing, his early stages of his writing life. And then also the Harriet Beecher Stowe House is in Hartford as well. There's the Connecticut Science Center. There's one of the oldest private art museums, actually, I believe the oldest art museum in the United States that's open to the public in the Wadsworth. So there's some cool stuff in Hartford that you can check out when you are not at a Goats game. And it was fun getting a chance to explore a little bit more beyond just the phenom that is the Hartford Yard Goats.
Right. And from a food and beverage or perspective outside of the ballpark, you know, the Yard Goats have had this steamed cheeseburgers alternate identity.
Right.
And that speaks to steamed hamburgers, steamed cheeseburgers being a Hartford specialty and some of the oldest examples of the classic American cuisine that is the hamburger in all the United States. So you can explore some old classic restaurants serving hamburgers the way that they were served when, you know, when Wimpy on Popeye was craving them and would gladly pay you Tuesday.
Not in Utica. No, that's an Albany expression. But it was a fun one to write up about Hartford. I have Altoona coming up next, which is People's Natural Gas Field. That will be out next week. Ben currently working on Syracuse. You can also, if you are a West Coast baseball fan, you can check out Josh Jackson's look at San Manuel Stadium in Inland Empire, where the 66ers have called home for quite some time, and a team that has produced so much talent. That was one of the teams that we kind of discussed, like, how do you define the inception of this team? Because they were known, they were the San Bernardino Storm for a while, the Stampede for a while, and then changed names, and the level has changed and all of that. But their roots go back into the 1980s. The ballpark opened in 1996, and that is a really cool place as well. They've got some great food options, and it's one of the things that's interesting to me about the California League is I don't think most people outside of the world of minor league baseball think about California as a minor league baseball hotbed. But there was a whole league named after that state. And now, of course, Low A West is included in the old footprint of the California League. But San Bernardino, a cool stop for the Inland Empire 66ers. Ben, you've been to that one relatively recently, correct?
Yeah, I went there, I believe, in 2017, I want to say. It all blurs together a little bit. It was a weeknight, so not a huge crowd and, you know, not the best weather, but it was the second time I've been there. And yeah, interesting place to see a game. Remember the first time I went there, they had a tooth race, you know, where racing teeth mascots sponsored by a local dentist. And that was when I was in my young and rugged and wild gorilla, G-U-E-R-R, whatever. I was a gorilla journalist. I'd like to fashion myself in that way. So yeah, I was a racing tooth in the Empire, which is definitely one of my enduring memories. And you guys know this, and anyone who goes to minor league games knows this, is like kids get obsessed with autographs.
Yeah.
And
kids and some adults.
And some adults.
Right. Right.
But especially kids. Like,
it's only cute when the kids do it.
Anyone in a costume, you want autographs. So I'm waiting for the third out so I can you know, be a molar in a tooth race. And these kids, like one after the other, kept coming up to me and asking for my autograph because I was just dressed as a tooth. And I remember just like, just one of those moments. And this was my first visit to Inland Empire when I was pretty new to traveling and still kind of making it up and still being like, I can't believe I'm doing this somehow as my job, just standing there dressed as a tooth and writing tooth on baseballs and caps that kids were giving to me. I just wrote tooth. I was like, I don't know what my name is. So I just signed their stuff tooth. And that's a great memory from Inland Empire. Not so much about the ballpark itself, but yeah, a lot of history in that franchise, going back through different identities and kind of a, I don't know if you call it Spanish colonial, but a very West Coast architectural feel to the ballpark and some mountains in the background and a name that, you know, speaks to Route 66. And that's quintessentially American.
It is indeed. And another state that Route 66 passes through and another community that Route 66 touches. Albuquerque, New Mexico is where we are headed on this week's episode of the show. Before the show, John Traub is going to join us coming up here in a little bit from Albuquerque. A Food Network project found its way to Isotopes Park this summer, which I was actually not even aware of until this week when it aired and when you guys passed this along. But Ben, give us the overview of what exactly the Topes got to take part in. And we also need to parse out where else in minor league baseball we feel like this could apply.
Yeah, the Isotopes, and we'll get, you know, deep into this in no time at all, but they were featured on an episode of Dinner Impossible on the Food Network, where the host, Robert Irvine, I believe is his name, was tasked with creating an elevated dinner at the ballpark and all the challenges involved with that and all sorts of time limitations and ingredient limitations. So it was reality TV at the ballpark with the Isotopes. So always interesting to see minor league baseball, you know, get featured, you know, just on TV through the lens of other shows and other concepts. And, you know, something I think is always fun to cover because then you get to see by talking to the teams involved a little bit of, you know, how the sausage gets made, so to speak, what it's like, you know, to be on the inside of being involved with these television productions. And of course, having your team featured and what that means to the team.
I feel like if there were regions of the country where minor league baseball could most clearly put its stamp on a show in that vein because of its regional delicacies, I'm very partial to a place like Albuquerque because I want to just inhale all of the green chili on earth. But I feel like there would be a lot of places where this could also go down. Ben, if you had to pick like a short list of ballparks where you feel like this would be a well-situated proposition outside of Albuquerque, where else would be?
Well, you could look at it this two ways. If you're looking at a show like Dinner Impossible, which is based around, you know, challenges and limitations, in a way it would be fun to pick an older ballpark with not too many with a small kitchen and not too many points of sale and having a really limited amount of things that you could make in there. I think even just from this year's travels, it's not that old of a ballpark, but Chattanooga AT&T Stadium, you know, pretty cramped in terms of their kitchen availability. So in one way, it'd be kind of fun to say, okay, this isn't a newer ballpark. You have to make the best of somewhere with a limited menu. But if you're thinking, what are the best ways in a reality TV show context to really explore the cuisine? I mean, I think Albuquerque is a great one. I think Lehigh Valley would be great just with all the creative concession items and the bacon-centric branding. I mean, along those lines, of course, we talked about Fresno tacos and all that a couple weeks ago on the show. And I think doing something based around Fresno and Mexican cuisine would be another great one for sure. But you could really just zero in on anywhere in the country and then find a reason that it would work, which I think is one of the great things. So I would recommend to television producers everywhere is to systematically feature every minor league ballpark on your show, no matter what your show is.
And make us producers.
Yeah, I'm into all of these ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that I will, as just an aside, not related to the food, but talking about minor league teams or ballparks being featured on television shows. If you have not seen this, you can find it on YouTube. The Savannah Sand Gnats, you know, who are not a minor league team anymore, Grayson Stadium, that is now the home of the Savannah Bananas, a you know, summer collegiate type team. They're right there, summer collegiate. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in 2006, I believe it was, an episode of the Ali G Show, a Borat segment of Ali G Show was filmed at a Sand Gnats game in like 2006, which begins with Borat singing the Kazakhstan national anthem. And he just goes on and on and on. And every time you think it's over, he keeps going and the staff's trying to start the game and inching over to him. And that sort of cringe comedy. And it gets more cringy from there. And I haven't seen it for a while. Maybe I shouldn't even be recommending it on a family podcast. I don't know, but it's kind of an interesting footnote in minor league baseball television history to think that a Borat segment was filmed in a minor league baseball game.
I have to go find this like now. That's going to be the first thing I do after this episode. I want you both to know. John Trott from the Albuquerque Isotopes coming up.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Albuquerque, New Mexico is the home of the Albuquerque Isotopes minor league team, and that name is in part a reference to The Simpsons. In recent years, Albuquerque's been on the map because of shows being set there, such as Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. A lot of movies and film are in Albuquerque. There's stuff shooting there all the time. And this season, the Albuquerque Isotopes themselves got a turn in front of the camera. They have been featured in an episode of the Food Network TV show Dinner Impossible. In season 10, episode 6, which aired Tuesday, and which I'm sure you can find via your local cable streaming providers, host Robert Irvine is in Albuquerque for Healthcare Worker Appreciation Night, and he's tasked with serving an elevated dinner to 250 deserving guests. But it's not that simple. He only has access to ballpark ingredients, and he must also prepare a New Mexico-themed snack for the 400 employees who open up the stadium for the game. So that's a Dinner Impossible setup. And here to talk about it from the inside, how it all went down, is Isotopes Vice President and General Manager, John Traub. Thanks for being with us, John.
Guys, it's a pleasure. Thrilled that you watched the show. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun to participate in, but hopefully you guys had fun watching it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons we wanted to do this segment is because it's obviously minor league fans who listen to this podcast. And if you haven't seen this, you don't get to see minor league baseball featured on, cable programming overall, and especially not the Food Network very often. So how did this come about? How did Dinner Impossible end up shooting the episode Seventh Inning Stress at your ballpark?
So, Ben, they called us, probably mid-June of last year, of 2021, and said that they wanted to talk about filming an episode of Dinner Impossible at the ballpark featuring the Isotopes. And my first question is, why us? And what made you think of coming here? And they said that the producer was a big baseball fan. Really, they had a kind of a regional need to do something filmed in the Southwest. So it just kind of hit their radar. So in a very, very short amount of time, we dotted the I's, crossed the T's, worked with Major League Baseball to get the licensing approvals done, worked with the network, worked with the production company. It was very much fast and furious. And even they came out to start filming. It was basically a 2.5-day production. All the filming took place on a Tuesday. They did a lot of B-roll on Monday, and they did a site survey on Sunday. And I would tell you that even Wednesday and Thursday leading up to that Sunday, the week before, we weren't 100% sure that it was going to come to fruition because, man, there are a lot of hurdles that you have to go through and people have to, sign off on. But we were able to get it done, and they came out and they brought a really large crew with them and did that site survey, as I mentioned, on Sunday. And everything went from there.
And you've been with the team for quite a long time. Was it better part of 2 decades now?
Well, I just finished my 34th year in the game, and with the Isotopes since 2002.
Yeah.
Our first season here was 03, but I was the general manager in Calgary before that, and we ran that into the ground and relocated that franchise to Albuquerque. So I did move with the team, but yeah, so been with the organization for a long time.
Yeah, and in that time, have you ever been involved in something like this? I know you've partnered with, you know, local television productions, you know, and promotions, you know, around Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, but have you ever had your team featured in such a way, or was this a new experience?
It was a brand new experience at this level. A couple of years ago, there was a British TV show, a cooking show. It was called like Two Hairy Guys on a Bike or something. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it aired on the BBC in England. And they came out and spent part of a day with us. I personally was not as involved in that one as I was in this one, but you know, they're still big productions and big, you know, the big crews and things like that. So it was neat to see how this type of production gets put together for sure.
Yeah. And as Ben was laying out there earlier, part of this show is creating a challenge for Robert Irvine and his team. So right. When you guys found out this was going to be something that was happening beyond just the logistical hurdles, at what point were you planning out what can we throw his way? Like, because what was involved in that was like the kitchen was in right field, but the pavilion where people were going to be serving was in left field. Like, how much did you guys think about how can we make this as entertaining a show as possible from our end?
From the very beginning, Sam, even the very first phone call that we got from them, we started talking about concepts. And one thing that I really wanted to do, and I thought it was going to be kind of cool, would be a behind the scenes on what it takes to present a challenge in real life to feed two professional baseball teams before the game, after the game, everything that's involved in that. You know, as we all know in this industry, you don't know what time games are going to end. You don't know what time the food needs to be ready, et cetera. So I thought that was going to provide some really interesting content. And I think they really like that concept, but unfortunately, due to COVID restrictions, we wouldn't be able to have the camera crews in the clubhouses or in the tents that were provided for the teams to eat. We wouldn't be able to get the camera crews very close to the players. So we spoke very briefly with our major league affiliate, the Colorado Rockies, about it. They were interested in the concept, but once we started talking to the production crew and realized how close the cameras were going to have to be, it came pretty clear pretty quickly that it really wouldn't be we wouldn't be able to proceed with that concept. So we pivoted, and you know, we really did dedicate the entire 2021 season to all the healthcare workers in our community to thank them for all the challenges and everything that they continue to go through to this day, in fact. And so we thought, well, what if we brought in a bunch of healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, whomever, and really have that be the elevated meal that Robert would provide? We talked about that. We talked about doing some things with other types of groups. And we filmed this on a Tuesday, and it was in June, the end of June. So we only had a very short window, like I said, to turn this around. So because of a healthcare partner, Loveless Health Systems, that we have here in Albuquerque, who's been a partner of ours since 2003, we reached out to them, gave them a heads up that this would be a possibility, and they started promoting it from within to get as many people, as many health workers involved as possible to be our special guest for that night. So long answer to your question, we did kick the tires on a few things, but I'm thrilled that they liked the idea of going with the healthcare workers, because it was not only timely, but impactful and important that we continue not just to provide lip service about providing thanks and honoring the healthcare workers, but actually delivering on that. And the healthcare workers, as you could see from the show, they were very appreciative.
Yeah. And one of the great things about this show too, is just showing off what, Southwest cuisine can be. And it's as much a showcase of Albuquerque food as it is the ballpark and the isotopes in general. I know you guys didn't want to have your fingers on the scale, but your chef was involved in helping craft all this kind of stuff. How much were you guys either telling them about Food Network, like, A, there needs to be green chiles in there, which there certainly were, but B, like, this is some of the stuff you might want to consider throwing in there as part of the meal?
I will be honest with you. I don't think it came up at all. It came up that as part of the challenge, they would have full access to any ingredient inside the ballpark that they could have. Certainly our chef was involved during the production to say, hey, you know, chilies and certain spices and things of this nature would be it as at his disposal. But there was no advanced grocery shopping. There was no advanced, you know, preparation of a menu. They showed up. That was very, very real. They showed up. They didn't know what their challenge was going to be. And when he asked me the question, or he asked our Chef Thomas the question, you know, what's at our disposal? Well, you got everything from hot dogs and hamburgers to all the sweet food, you know, the food that we prepare for our hospitality and our special culinary team could put together whatever. It was a matter of what was available on hand that day. So that did provide quite a bit of a challenge for them.
John, from the standpoint of shooting a live television program, you can do all the advanced planning and the advanced concepts that you want. But once the cameras go on and the gates go open and all of that, things are going to change. And there's not really a cut and let's reset and start this thing over element to doing it during a minor league baseball game. So tell us about, feel free to go into as much or as little detail as you would like. But we know that there are some other unexpected challenges. Give us a little bit of the lowdown.
So, like I said, we filmed on Tuesday, and on Monday, there was a little bit of a walkthrough, if you will, a little bit of a rehearsal, I guess, with myself and the chef and our mascot. And Robert and his team did not show up. So when you saw them walk into the stadium during the show, that was Tuesday morning, and it's go time. They had no preliminary idea of what was going to happen. Now, they've filmed these shows now for 10 seasons, so they kind of have their formula. And as part of the production, they liked the host, which was, I guess, in this case was me. They said, okay, this is kind of what we want you to do. We want you to welcome them. We want you to present the challenge. We want you to hit on a few key words, which are not a typical part of my vernacular. So when we're talking about providing an elevated meal in the stadium, that was a little bit of a challenge for me to get out, because it's just not something that I would ordinarily say. So we rehearsed it on Monday. We walked through some things. They had cameras in certain positions, I think just to get us comfortable with kind of how the setup was going to be. We were set up at shortstop. It was a pretty decent day. And we felt pretty good about things. And they were hoping that, okay, we can get some B-roll and kind of use some of this as part of the production. Well, that's fine. That was Monday. Tuesday morning, we wake up and it's pouring rain, which it never does here, especially during monsoon season, which starts right around that time. You know, it's a beautiful morning until about 2-3 o'clock when the clouds rolls in normally. And then the thunderstorms hit, the monsoons hit, and then it sends us into a little bit of a panic mode for games during the month of July usually. But anyhow, on this particular Tuesday, it rained all day. And the tarp was on the field overnight Monday night. So all that rehearsal, all that B-roll, all that stuff that we prepared on Monday, we had to scrap it. And in fact, the producer called me really early in the morning and he's like, yeah, we're going to have to pivot. We're going to have to figure something else out. So no problem. We figured out where we could be under the protection of the concourse. It's not necessarily the look that I think we wanted or anybody wanted. Of course, you want blue skies and green grass and, you know, have that kind of thing, but it wasn't meant to be because, you know, the weather didn't cooperate. So we had to improvise, but they did give me that kind of, okay, these are the types of things we want to hit. And this is what he's going to ask you basically, but nobody had a script. And from the get-go, when we walked up and said hello to him and it was on camera and we knew they were rolling, they had four or five different cameras rolling, you know, I just had to react to what Robert was saying. And then it was go time. It was in real time. There was no cut. Let's say this again. It was let's go. And they were going to have to produce the show based on whatever garbage came out of my mouth. So I was nervous about that because, like I said, there were some things that the types of things that they wanted us to hit on. And it took, I didn't want to think about it too much. I didn't want to overthink it because then I would really stumble over my words. I just like to speak freely and I think it came out okay. Even though sometimes if you watch the show closely, you could tell that, man, I've got marbles in my mouth, but it worked out okay, I think.
No, I think you did great, John, at being a host for, you know, Isotopes Ballpark and Albuquerque at large. But speaking of it raining, one thing that stood out to me in that show is probably wouldn't have happened if it was a blue sky, green grass day that you're talking about. You made Robert Irvine tarp pole. So at what point were you guys just like, hey, we're going to make him do this thing that everybody in a minor league front office has to do?
Well, throughout the day, you know, they really wanted to present challenges to Robert as part of making this thing happen. So they were already on a tight time crunch. And the producer said, what can we do? You know, what types of things happen during the day around a minor league ballpark that basically require a lot of people to be involved? And it was perfect because the tarp was already down. The tarp was down from the night before, like I said, but it was like, well, we could use his help pulling the tarp. So they said, okay, let's have him do that. Great. So at a certain time, they had actually asked us to delay the tarp pull so that they could get their cameras in place. And we're like, and my groundskeeper's like, there's no way that that is happening. That tarp's coming off right now. I don't care if the crew is here or not. We got to get rolling because we got to start this game on time. So, I mean, what you saw was legit. It was me going into the kitchen. Robert, we want to get this game started on time. And in order to do that, this tarp has to get off now and we need your help. Now, ordinarily, I probably wouldn't go into the kitchen to ask our chef for help, but that was a little bit of a thing for TV, but it worked out well. I think he had a good time doing rolling up the tarp. We didn't get down there in time to dump it, but we did get down there in time to roll it up.
Yeah. And one other aspect of it that I enjoyed, because all of this stuff, reality TV, there needs to be some ticking clock somewhere, but there is no ticking clock in baseball outside of a pitch clock, if that's instituted. But you guys kind of set up the deadline as the end of the third inning, which all of a sudden, like, now you're following what he's doing with how many outs are there in the second, how many outs are there in the third, and there's somebody updating him. So how did you guys like work with the team to decide this is when we're going to do this, and this is going to make, you know, a timeless game into a time atmosphere?
Well, if you think about it, right, most times when people are eating dinner at a game, they're doing it relatively early in the game. Initially, they had conversations with us. They wanted to feed everybody in the seventh inning. It's like, well, geez, that could be 3 hours. You know, they've already been here for an hour before the game, and then it's 3 hours into the. So it's like, no, this has to be done earlier. So we told them, yeah, this is going to be after the third inning, and then we added the additional challenge of adding a snack for our event staff who showed up. So that kind of just threw another wrinkle into it, but it was really firm. It was like, hey, this has to be done by the end of the third inning, which should be around 7:30. The game started at 6:35 that night. And so that was their clock. And I do have to give now our former PR director, Kevin Collins, a shout out, because I really think that he was one of the stars of the show, because having him run in to say, okay, we're in the first inning. Okay. Now we're in the second inning. We got through two outs to go. I thought that was a really cool piece of the thing, because it added that urgency. And the time clock that you saw when you're watching the show, you know, the countdown, 3.5 hours to service time or 42 minutes to first pitch, whatever, all that was real time. All that was legit. There was no sugarcoating that was real. From the time they showed up, that clock was ticking for sure.
John, let me just ask you about you said you've been with the Topes now since 2002. And it was perfect that Ben noted that, you know, you've got a team name that's based in part on a television show episode. Since then, I would say that the Isotopes have probably been the most TV-friendly franchise in minor league baseball over the last several years, and it's due in part to the explosion of the television and film industry in New Mexico, but from being, you know, in Breaking Bad and in Better Call Saul, and now, you know, having a Food Network piece that comes out of the ballpark. If you would have gone back to 2002 and talk to the version of yourself that started with the Isotopes, how would you explain what this additional element of the Topes has become for you guys as a franchise over the last decade plus now?
Tyler, that's a great question. Obviously, when we did the Name the Team contest way back when, the Simpsons episode was airing that had the Springfield Isotopes potentially moving to Albuquerque to become the Albuquerque Isotopes. So pop culture has certainly been part of our fabric since we started. And we didn't know that a show called Breaking Bad was going to happen, or Better Call Saul was going to happen, or any of these other things. But, you know, you look at Bull Durham, you look at MASH with the Toledo Mud Hens and several others. Minor league baseball is part of the fabric of this country. And you look at a variety of shows. Geez, I mean, you name it. There's even in the movie Love Actually, there's a minor league baseball pennant in the background of a scene in a bar in Milwaukee. So there's just all kinds of different examples of how minor league baseball crosses over to TV and movies and whatnot. So I don't want to sit here and say, yeah, we were planning this or we were hoping for it, but some of this stuff just comes along. I mean, we are talking to a TV crew, right, or a filmmaking crew right now about renting out the facility later this month to shoot a movie. There was a TV show in the around 2007, 2008 called In Plain Sight. And to be honest with you, that was probably the first show that actually used the ballpark for filming and called themselves the Isotopes. There have been other movie specs that have been written around our existence and things like that. We market ourselves as being a community venue. We try to be a good community partner, and it's a great venue. It doesn't always correlate to what TV and film production want, right? There was a movie that they were kicking the tires many, many years ago. I can't tell you how many site location tours I've given over the years. A huge number of them and a very, very small percentage actually come to fruition. But they wanted our ballpark to both either in production or post-production, they were going to try to make it look like Wrigley Field. And it's like, no, that good luck. I'm not sure that that's going to happen, right? So we love being part of the pop culture. We see questions every so often on Jeopardy that come up and things like that. And I just think it's cool. You know, it's kind of fun. It's just one of those added benefits of having a team that was on the front end of being kind of one of the untraditional names. You know, you have a team called the Isotopes and in a different type of community and a awesome but different type of stadium. It's going to create that interest and we're glad that the things that have happened have been able to work out the way they have.
Now, John, to close things out, Sam and I were talking prior to this interview, you know, trying to get a little more background information. And we were looking into how often Albuquerque is used as a location for TV and film. And we found one article that called it Tamalewood. And we just like a local perspective. Does anyone call it Tamalewood?
It's the first time I've ever heard that. But I think that's a great name. There's stuff that happens here all the time. Netflix just bought the huge movie production or film production location called Albuquerque Studios, and that's where Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad and gosh, so many other productions have taken place there. So there are some huge productions that have happened in our community, and they get a lot of publicity. And so that's kind of cool. And everybody knows that now the filmmaking industry has really become part of the economy in this state. And in fact, before the tax incentives that the state of New Mexico introduced, Breaking Bad was originally scheduled to take place in Riverside, California. And right around that time, the state of New Mexico stepped up with some incentives and they pivoted and Albuquerque became the home for Breaking Bad, and the city of Albuquerque itself really became a character in that show, if you will, and an important part of the character of that show. And it's just rolled on from there. I mean, it's a really cool thing that's happening in our community.
Well, hopefully this conversation has whetted your appetite, so to speak, to watch the episode of Dinner Impossible featuring the Albuquerque Isotopes airing on the Food Network. It debuted on Tuesday, and I'm pretty sure it'll air quite a few more times going forward now. So check your local listings and see if they were successful in creating elevated cuisine at the ballpark. And to steal my own joke from Twitter, you'd think it'd be pretty easy to create elevated cuisine because the ballpark is 5,100 feet above sea level. Where's my rim
pausing,
shot?
Pausing for
I was quiet there. Ben, I was quiet on purpose because I was figuring that's the kind of reaction you got on Twitter as well. But
it was.
I got to tell you, I did read that and I thought that was pretty clever. How come I didn't think of that? So
yeah, that's what I'm here to be, clever and unfunny.
John, you also, you have to start using all of these awkward terms now, John, in your everyday life. Like I want you from now on, like, you know, it's 5:30, you're getting set for first pitch for a game. And I want you to be like, what sort of elevated dinners do we have around here tonight?
Can I give you a personal story? This Please. Is a true thing. So my wife is an unbelievable cook and is very creative about looking in the pantry, looking in the freezer, looking whatever. Okay, what do we have? And what are we going to put together? So I really think that my wife started the Dinner Impossible scenario before it became a TV show. And so I got to give her a lot of... So it was just funny just watching them put the show together and watching the show with her, because I had not told her a lot about it. She goes... Why do that? I said, yes, you do. I said, you could become a creative consultant on
You're
the
like,
show.
I've been watching this for years at home.
I've been living this. Come on. So anyway.
I hope she makes the chicken wing nachos. That's the thing I wanted to try most, I think.
Those were good. Those were very good.
That was such a great idea.
For sure. Thank you guys so much for your interest in this. And this was a lot of fun. Thanks for letting me share some stories.
Yeah, great speaking with you, John. And thanks for being a guest on the Show Before the Show podcast.
You got it. Thanks, guys.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Huge thanks to John Traub of the Albuquerque Isotopes for joining the show. Now I very much want breakfast laden with green chili. It's noon here, but I haven't really had like a full breakfast yet. So I might just go, whip something up. I got some green chili from New Mexico in the fridge. It sounds fantastic to me. We are moving along to talk about all things Fall Stars, as the 2021 edition of the Arizona Fall League Showcase game is coming up on Saturday. It will be on MLB Network. It'll be simulcast on MLB.com and on the MLB app as well. But yeah, it's already Fall Stars time of the year, which means we're just over a week away from the close of the Arizona Fall League season. But the East and West rosters announced for the Arizona Fall League's Fall Stars game, and some really exciting talent, as you would imagine, of course, on these rosters. There are 7 combined top 100 prospects, 4 on the East roster, 3 on the West roster. 2 more prospects will be added via the Final Stars Final 2 vote, the Fall Stars Final 2 vote, that is. And, give us a rundown of your initial impressions of these rosters here for this 2021 edition of this game. Sam, we, of course, did not have an AFL last year, didn't have a Fall Stars game last year. So we haven't seen one since 2019 when the AFL East won that contest 4-2. Royce Lewis of the Minnesota Twins was named the Fall Stars MVP. But give us the initial impression you've got from this one.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly what the Fall Stars game should be, looking at these rosters right now. There was this, I don't want to say confusion, but I think a lot of people kind of jump out on Twitter when the rosters were announced this week, that it's an all-star game. It is that in some way, but it's not in the typical sense. You almost have to think about it kind of as like a futures game. This isn't right. Based solely on Fall League performance. It would be a little cheap to do that given how short the Fall League really is. But it's also not wholly just based on like who the best prospects in the league are. If that was the case, then Marco Luciano wouldn't be in the final two voting. He would have been, you know, easily one of the prospects to make the cut. So it's kind of a mix of both, kind of treated as a futures game. This is just a showcase game for, hey, these are a bunch of guys who have we knew coming into the Fall League, and B, have done pretty well. So you mentioned 7 top 100 prospects are on the roster. Let's go through those real quick. Tristan Casas of the Boston Red Sox, first baseman representing the East. Gabriel Moreno, catcher of the Blue Jays. Brett Beatty, third baseman for the Mets. And J.J. Blade, outfielder for the Marlins. Those are the East representatives. Out West, we've got Nick Gonzalez, middle infielder for the Pirates. Bobby Miller, right-handed pitcher for the Dodgers. And Bryson Stott, shortstop for the Phillies. So seven top 100 prospects all in one game. That's always going to make us pay attention. There are some other big names participating this year for sure. Looking at guys like Patrick Bailey, catcher for the Giants, Curtis Meade for the Rays, who anybody who listened to last week's episode, I really wanted on my my fall league team. Tyler took him.
Did you get him?
I did not get him.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He's on my team.
Thank you
that's
for reminding me of that. Although that was my own fault.
That's
I will
true.
Be honest.
That is true. I was going to let you sail through on it, but
yeah, you know. I took Brett Beatty at third base when I could have taken Curtis Meade. That's on me. I'm not going to be upset about that.
You could have.
Just to throw that out there. Sully Matias, I think, could be a standout because one of the great things about this game, which will be broadcast on MLB Network, it's also available on MLB.com and the MLB app. It'll be airing at 7 p.m. Eastern this Saturday when you guys hear this. So November the 13th. But one great thing about it is because it's played at Salt River, we do get StatCast app for this game. And you can pour over that on Baseball Savant page. I will tweet out the Baseball Savant page as well. So make sure to follow me on Twitter for that game. But it's just, we get so much more data coming in on these guys. And Sully Matias is a boomer bust prospect for sure, but he has every capability of hitting multiple 450-foot home runs on Saturday with exit velocities of 110 miles an hour plus. He could also strike out four times in all of his plate appearances. Like, he's going to be boom or bust, but that just seeing some of these guys kind of stand out. Abner Uribe, who's a pitcher in the Brewer system, I think when I looked it up earlier today, he had 13 of the 14 fastest pitches thrown at Salt River this year. He can easily touch triple digits. He's involved in the game. So if you want to look at a StatCast darling, he is certainly one of those. Some other pitchers, Cole Henry has had a really strong fall league. Owen White has had a strong fall league. Both of those guys representing the West. Could they get in short spurts? I kind of hope we'd see it because, again, this is a showcase game. But, yeah, those are just some of the names to follow in the Fall Stars game. And, hey, there is some research out there. I think Fangraphs did it a few years ago, that being named to a Fall Stars roster is indicative of future success. Now, it's a chicken of the egg or the egg thing we've talked about. Typically, your top prospects are going to be in this game anyways. If they're top prospects, they're usually good, which means they're going to have major league success. But still, it is interesting to note that research, so do seek that out. I think it has a hit rate of about like 1 in 3 for young position players that guys eventually become solid major leaguers. So a good portion of these guys that will be taking the field Saturday will be playing in the bigger stadiums and be playing productive roles. So we're not just saying that. There is research behind that. But all that said, Tyler, out of the names I've said so far, maybe somebody else you have on your radar, who would be your MVP prediction for Saturday?
I am going with a dude who has put together a very good campaign so far in the AFL, and that's JJ Bleda of the Miami Marlins organization. As of right now, he's got an OPS still over 1,000 in the AFL. And, you know, a guy who just, as we talked about last week, 2 weeks ago, I just feel like I'm not worried about JJ Bleda. I know the 2021 season wasn't great for him at Double A Pensacola. He's batting .329 with a 1050 OPS as of right now in the AFL. And he seemingly has just kind of ironed out things. He started the month of November with a 5-hit day in which he was a triple shy of the cycle, hashtag a triple shy. He's got 3 homers this month through his first 8 games, played in November. He was fantastic in October as well. But I like what JJ Bleda is doing lately, so I'm going with him.
Yeah, my pick is going to be Juan Yepez.
Okay, another good choice.
Just a guy, we talked about him before. I think he was my DH pick last week. He just hit everywhere he played this year. Double A, Triple A, got added to the Cardinals wild card roster. That isn't continued here in the fall league, playing for Glendale. He's batting .319. He's got a .390 OBP, but being a corner outfield guy, but probably going to be a first baseman, which is a problem in St. Louis and Paul Goldschmidt, but that's neither here nor there right now. He is a slug first guy. He's slugging .710, got a .110 OPS, or an 1100 OPS, excuse me. He's got 7 homers in 18 games. So he's hitting the ball hard. He's doing it pretty consistently. When I was there the first 2 weeks, he was hitting. That's continued up until now. He just had a 2-homer game recently. So he's shown no signs of slowing down. It's not like fall league pitchers are figuring him out. I think he's hitting his stride at the right time. I thought he could be somebody who maybe would have flamed out just because he played so many games during the summer, then going to the wild card. Like, this could be a severe drop off, but he seems to kind of thrive in these environments and being able to show that maybe he was overlooked earlier in his career, and prospect rankings are starting to catch on to him now. They will especially do that given the way he finished the year and given what he's doing in the fall league. And I think the showcase that is the Fall Stars game will be another big opportunity for him. So Juan Yepez, he might be my pick because he could have one homer, a double in a three hit game and easily take that. But just to look back on some other Fall Stars MVPs of recent vintage, Royce Lewis was that in 2019, Buddy Reed in 2018, Victor Robles in 2017, Willie Calhoun 2016, and Gary Sanchez in 2015. So some varying degrees of success, but guys who have made the major leagues for the most part and been, like we said, productive members in that, whether for the long-term or short-term, whatever. But if you win the MVP award, it's probably a good sign that you are going to make the majors pretty soon, if not almost immediately afterwards.
So coming up on Saturday, 7 o'clock Eastern time, 5 o'clock local time in Scottsdale, Salt River Fields at Talking Stick for first pitch between the East and West in the 2021 edition of the Fall Stars game for the Arizona Fall League. You can follow that not only live broadcast on MLB Network, but also on MLB.com and the MLB app. And we'll be back to wrap this thing up. Coming up next, Josh Jackson swings by with Ghost of the Miners, and we'll say goodbye on the other side.
Interrupt this podcast to bring you another thrilling edition of Ghosts of the Miners. Now, here's your correspondent and host, Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Ghosts of the Miners, in which all of you out there in Radioland must identify the legitimate historical ball club hiding amidst the fraudulent pair. One played ball in 1935. The others were never even alive. In the last segment, I asked you which of the following minor league baseball teams did at one time exist. A. The Sayersville Steeds. B. The Canyon Lake Jackrabbits. C. The Union City Greyhounds. If you blinked, you missed them. But in 35, the Union City Greyhounds, C, did indeed race onto the scene in the Kitty League. That's Kentucky, Illinois, Tennessee League. The inaugural team was piloted by Rip Fanning, who went on to win 338 games as manager in the Kitty League. Old Rip lived a long life as a sportsman, passing on in 1982 at the age of 83. R.I.P. Fanning. Based in the Tennessee town founded at the union of the Nashville Northwestern Railroad and the Mobile, Ohio Railroad, the Greyhounds ran circles around the competition to finish in the first two spots in the league for each of their first three seasons, with stars like Dutch Dumbler, Bill Shuey, and Elbert Hodge, it's no wonder those early Greyhounds were ahead of the pack. But in 38, they ran into a wall, going 45-85 to place 8th out of 8. A decade later, enjoying a post-war affiliation with Cleveland, Union City finished 2nd in the 48 regular season and claimed another title via the playoffs. The Greyhounds made another chase for a crown without a parent club in 52, but got in deep against the Madison Miners in the Kitty League Finals. The next year, the team agreed to an affiliation with the Brooklyn organization and changed its name to the Union City Dodgers. Coincidentally, the 1953 National League Dodgers featured 1952 Rookie of the Year, Joe Black, the right-hander who, after baseball, went on to become an executive with Greyhound Bus Line. But it was the partnership with the Dodgers that ran the Greyhounds out of the minors. And that's how those dogs of Union City had their day. Now, on to the question for next time. Which of these smarty pants clubs used their brains in the minors of yesteryear? A. The Bethlehem Bookworms. B. The Logan Collegians. C. The Williamsburg Philosophers. Want to know the answer? Get thinking. or tune into the next Ghosts of the Miners. But for now, you'll have to excuse me. My producer Ben Hill is making a transatlantic journey, and I've got to warn the French.
For this week's episode of the show before the show, keep your eyes peeled. I never know what that phrase means. Just keep checking MILB.com and MLB.com/pipeline for all of our stuff. We've got some new logo stuff coming up soon. I don't want to give too much away, but I've got some stuff that I'm going to be working on. Ben's got some stuff that he's going to be working on, some new identities, some refreshed identities. That stuff will be coming out next week and week after. And those are some of my favorite things to get a chance to write about and also to plot how I'm going to waste money on. So it's good. Which of these hats will I be buying?
I know. Yeah. When we were talking to John off mic, you do this perfectly because you have a backdrop of just hats on hats on hats on hats.
Yeah, it's kind of
like a great way to open any discussion with any guest we have.
It is. I feel like it is very disarming whenever people come on. They're not like intimidated by the podcast. They're like, look at this idiot and all of his hats.
Especially when it's somebody from Albuquerque who knows you've been to the ballpark multiple times. He's like, how many Topes hats do you have?
And I showed him my column of Topes hats. I've got four in one column. And then I've also got the Mariachis, which is, of course, their Copa identity that they've won multiple Copa de la Versión titles for, as well as the Green Chili Cheeseburgers hat. And John said, how many of those have you paid for? And I said, all of them, which is true. But then I wanted to say, well, are you saying that I could get free ones from you? Will you send me free ones, John? What is that all about?
That's one thing we have never really done on this show. And I say that sincerely. Like, we've never ended an interview be like, okay, thanks so much for joining us. By the way,
can you send us some stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, we wouldn't turn it down.
You know? We wouldn't, but we are honest folks who won't ask for it directly. We'll just shyly, you know, throw it passive aggressively at the end of the podcast.
Exactly. We do a good job, I feel like, of making people feel as though, oh, I can handle these dorks. We'll be fine. This conversation, it'll be very easy for me.
Yeah. It only takes 2 seconds of talking to us or 5 minutes of listening to the podcast.
Right. to realize that we are not impressed with ourselves. Well, that wraps up another fun and enlightening and entertaining edition of the Show Before the Show podcast. You can follow us on Twitter. He is at Sam Dykstra, MILB. Benjamin Hill is at Ben's Biz. I am at Tyler Mon. And get in touch with the show, podcast@MILB.com. And tune into the Fall Stars game coming up this weekend from Arizona. We'll be back to preview the final week of the AFL and the AFL championship game coming up next weekend. As crazy as that is to believe. To send us really fully into the doldrums of the offseason. So for Sam Dykstra and Benjamin Hill, I'm Tyler Mott. We'll talk to you next week.